Welcome to CXO 4.0 from Sullivan & Stanley. In our first podcast series, I'm going to cover a multitude of topics for business leadership in the 21st century. We will examine topics ranging from dysfunctioning boards through digital innovations, ways of working, interim and fractional working, and on to C-suite of the future. With technology on tap, what do our leaders believe this means for leadership roles? So my name is Ken Towning, and I'm here with Steve Robinson. I'm an advisor at Sullivan & Stanley, a fractional interim, and I also do some non-exec advisory roles also. I've been more recently focusing on helping and supporting execs in all kinds of businesses, and in particular, I focus on the application of technology in what is now a phenomenal digital era. And Steve, apart from being my former boss, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I had quite a varied background, actually. Quite a lot of blue chip roles in my early career. So I was CFO of Argos. I set Tesco Direct up for Tesco, although quite a few people have claimed to do that, which is interesting over the years that I've come across. Customer director at B&Q, and I've worked in a couple of VC/PE-backed businesses. So I was CEO of M&M Direct and CEO of Ashika. But these days I have my own digital consultancy called OmniCommerce. I'm chairman of a video mums network called Channel Mum. And I work with Downing Ventures as a venture partner. So I spend a lot of time in that sort of VC startup environment and those types of companies.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and I think having corporate and startup experience complements each other so much. I don't think people really realize once you've worked in both, just what you can bring to both areas. So it's interesting that you not only have your own startups and businesses, but you're still advising and consulting larger ones too. So we've picked a topic today for today. It's the growing pains of a business. We'll focus on startups, but of course, I suspect much of what we'll talk about could also be applied to scaling, acquisition and mergers, or even unicorns. So we're going to discuss those pains and some of the actions leaders can take to prevent, certainly realize, and even deal with some of those growing pains. And I thought it'd be interesting to start with starting out in a startup. So, you know, something probably is in your more recent history, given what you've just said.
Yeah, and in fact, one thing I forgot to mention, we've got a small little bedlinen business as well that I sort of set up on the side, which keeps me busy from time to time. And I'd say the biggest thing is the funding at the start. You know, you need to get sort of someone to trust your vision as an individual, what you're trying to achieve, trust you as a person, and in most cases, unless you can fund it yourself, give you a bit of money to get you going, and that tends to be in many cases a friend and family network, you know, or some wealthy individuals that like to place some of those sort of tax efficient SEIS and EIS sort of seed investments. I don't come across many people who manage to convince a VC straight off the bat with a business plan that it's something that's investable, although it can happen. In most cases I see, you tend to have needed a little bit of money or at least a bit of headspace in your own earning sort of situation to get things off the ground to a point where they're investable. And that's, you know, that's the first challenge. I think straight on after that is, you know, most things you can't do on your own, and you need a couple of people around you. You know, those early times are exhilarating, but can be quite testing. So, you know, you need to find people around you with complementary skill sets, the same work ethic, that you trust. And we'll come onto that in a second. And also that, you know, again, if you put them in front of people, that they're investable. So, it's, you know, there's a couple of pretty big challenges when you start out.
And in terms of, you know, you mentioned family, friends, high net worths and others, we personally put in a lot of money into these early investments, and sometimes cripplingly so. So how do you, do you have any advice on how people might go finding those high net worths or somebody who might be prepared? It's interesting you talk about the tax efficiencies. I've seen conversations only recently on how people are looking to diversify small pots of money and not rely on these governed funds that are offered to them.
Yeah, I mean, we're fortunate at the moment, and there's always been talk that this won't continue in the same vein, but the EIS is a great way of people investing into companies. You get a tax relief on the money going in. It's capital gains tax free. You've got downside protection. I can't remember the exact number, but for an SEIS investment, your downside risk is something like 12%. So it's a very tax efficient way, although you're obviously tying your money up for a while in something that you may lose 12% of. But so there are people out there that like to make those investments. Finding them, as you've said, isn't necessarily the easiest of things to do, and convincing them to part with their money, but they are out there. We'll talk about sort of latter stage funding, I guess in a minute, but my biggest bit of advice is it's just not going to fall at your feet. And in businesses that I've set up I've suffered from not speaking to enough people, and businesses that I've helped advise and that say, look, we're not getting any bites, and you're like, well, how many people have you spoken to? So, you know, it is a massive numbers game. You literally have to throw the net far and wide, and even when you get some nibbles, the chances of those turning into an investment are probably slim, and people could pull out any time. So you need to fill the bucket with more money than you need, and if that means disappointing someone along the way, that's, so be it.
Interesting. And there are companies like Cedars and Power of the Crowd type organizations that can try and help. But of course, to one of your earlier points, you don't really know who those investors are and what their behaviors might be.
Yeah, I have to declare a bit of interest. I ran a crowdfunding platform for a short period of time. So I know the area pretty well and all those players. And, there's a whole range from well-connected networks of private individuals that actually trust those types of middleman to do a bit of DD and put appropriate things in front of them. And, so that's I'd say the more serious part of the market. Then you've got a more consumer sort of based end, which is the people like Crowdcube play in, which is typically lots of individuals putting very small amounts of money in, and they they tend to actually, it's a bit of a sort of herd mentality. They tend to follow other people and other people's investment, and typically when things go on those platforms, they're quite highly invested in already, maybe 60-70% of their maximum, and they always end up at 150%. And so there is a whole range, and probably for a separate podcast, but you know that in my experience, actually you can get quite a long way with your own network, or at least friends of friends, if not your own friends, if you at least are persistent with it.
Great, thank you. And you mentioned there quite early on about realizing as an individual you can't do everything yourself. Interesting, because I have a business which I'm starting, and right now I am doing everything myself, including some tech development, which is quite interesting when you have to Google how to overcome some problems. But there is a point, and when is that point? How quickly do you have to recognize that you can't do everything yourself? Is it immediately? Is it something you just need to pull on volunteer value time, or how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, again, it depends who you have in your network. So if you're doing it with some mates, then that becomes an easier thing to do, and you share the burden. And I've certainly come across, in my experience, but guys that have done it and girls have done it with their friends initially, or people that they've done it with before, perhaps. I've seen husband and wife teams, which is an interesting one. I actually worked with my wife, so there's lots of different ways of doing it without actually having to pay anyone. in the early days. But the reality is there's not a concept out there that is going to be a one man or one woman band. So, you know, you are going to need some help, and that will typically be reliant on you putting some money in or someone else putting some money in. And then it's, you know, you're into the who can you afford, and you know, you're very likely to have to give some equity away to excite someone. They tend to be, and this isn't an ageist thing, they tend to be slightly younger and slightly more have a higher appetite for risk in terms of what they're doing, because as you get older, you've got wider responsibilities, and unless you've made a load of money before, you've got kids to feed and mortgages to pay, and so you sort of start to fish in a slightly smaller pond of people. And in fact, you can't even afford some of those people that have got more experience, because you know you're taking a risk on someone who perhaps this is their first roll out of a blue chip or something, rather than having someone who's got 10 years experience. And that those people will come eventually, but they typically will be after perhaps a Series A or even a Series B fundraise. So at that early stage, you're likely to be reliant on someone where their role is going to be a little bit of a stretch for them. And they'll be doing a lot of Googling because yeah. I'm in that camp. You know, there's not a thing out there that you can't find somewhere that someone can give you a bit of advice on. So,
And my experience is that those early starters or certainly the early employees tend to be quite broadly talented. They can pretty much put their hands to anything and invariably need to.
Yeah. Yeah. There's two things to touch on here really. So one is, and again, it'll come on as you grow as a business, but you should never underestimate the amount of time as a CEO or founder will be fundraising. You know, as soon as you've finished a fundraising round, you know, you almost need to be starting the next one. And those absorb a hell of a lot of time through due diligence processes, through even just getting down to a short list of possible investors. It's just so time consuming. And so I've always say to people, you know, if you've got the opportunity to take more money, even if it means slightly greater dilution of your equity, then do it, because you're only as good as your last round, and it's so time consuming. So that's one thing. I wouldn't also underestimate the challenges in the areas of finance and IT. And so many of the entrepreneurs that I come along, you know, all of them are brilliant, very driven, very creative. Not many who are financially sort of done a chartered accountancy or whatever. They tend to be in the minority, and not many of them that are sort of CTOs and write a load of code, unless it's a real tech business. You know, if it tends to be something like a retail or consumer business,
yes,
they tend to be from the more creative side of life, and so often they underestimate the need to have a very good finance and a very good IT person, and that can lead to all sorts of problems further down the line.
Yeah, that's interesting. Onboarding the skills early on. My experience matches yours. Entrepreneurs tend to have millions of ideas, and that needs to be contained in the right way, but also delivered. And they're not the delivery types that can do that.
It's because you grow so rapidly, and this is obviously all about growing pains. As you start to scale at a pace in most organizations that is out of your control, and is never linear. And so there'll be times when you slow and they'll need new initiatives, or there'll be, you know, times when you're growing too fast to keep up, or whatever it is. It's never, you know, no one ever hits their business plan numbers, that's for sure. They're always either above or below by definition. And you overtrade in many cases, and so the things that get strained in those overtrading is typically your financial processes and your IT infrastructure. And then in the periods where it's more of a lull, you know, then you really do need your finance person to be on their game, because you need to be all over the cash flow. You need to decide, you know, do you need to slim down investment, slim down, you know, the team or whatever it is. So, you know, if you haven't got someone in your immediate group of management who has got those finance and IT skills, you know, it doesn't matter how brilliant your idea is. You're going to hit the, you know, some bumps in the road and not be able to deal with them.
And that comes nicely into balancing your time as a founder and CEO. We touched on it just there. We, when you think of the marketing activities, the growing the business activities, the operational side of the business, how on earth does a, particularly a startup CEO, manage that kind of growing pain where now they have to really look at, and it won't be in their DNA, but they have to really look at how they're splicing their time up across all those things.
Yeah, and I, you know what, I've seen all sorts of characters out there through, you know, through my work, and I'd say you have to be able to delegate to people. So you have to be able to trust people that you can give stuff to. And I've definitely come across those who can delegate, and I've come across those who need to do everything. And they're both, you know, probably equally successful and unsuccessful. So, but in my personal opinion is, you know, you will increase your chance of success if you can at least trust people to do their job in many cases and not micromanage every decision, which can be tough when it's a younger team with less experience. So there's a bit of balancing there. As I've said, don't underestimate the fundraising. So that's going to probably take you out for periods of time. You know, it could be 60-70% of your time, you know, and even then you'll probably be working most evenings and weekends to land that. And then you've got the leadership part of, you know, just spending time with people, inspiring them. It's not for the faint-hearted, that's for sure, because you are constantly juggling. And through all of that, you've got to maintain this sort of element of it's going to be all right, because at times it looks like it may not be in many cases. And I had one particular example of a business I was working in where the finance guy, you know, he would sort of open a spreadsheet in his open plan office, and he was like shaking his head all the time, and you're like, God, you know, you got a load of, you know, you're sort of people there that are along the journey with you in this sort of business that's, you know, could be a bit touch and go, and you've got to always keep this air of it's going to be all right, because otherwise they'll go and work somewhere else, or, you know, they won't be performing at their best. So it is, it's a very difficult task to manage everything. So my biggest bit of advice is learn how to delegate to some people. And also, I'm a big advocate of, you know, you're never going to get everything right in any organization. It could be the big businesses I've worked in, like Tesco and Argos, or it could be some of the startups. The fact is, it's almost impossible to make every decision correctly and to basically, you know, land the helicopter on the pinhead every time. And so you need to very quickly work out what are the important things that you definitely need to get right, and what are the unimportant things that you don't need to worry about so much. And, you know, I'd be delegating all of those out and not being too concerned with the sort of wording of a sort of piece of text on a website and have to sign that off. But, you know, I'd be really interested in, you know, looking at the cash flow and seeing when the money runs out in a bit more detail, even though perhaps it wouldn't take me outside of my comfort zone because I'm an accountant, but it might take a CEO outside of their comfort zone.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, segueing into the next piece, what are the sort of key indicators that one should look for when you're looking at, because we talked about growing pains there almost as if it's an individual thing. It's not just the business is growing, has growing pains, but the individual is feeling those pains. But I guess for the business, you need to be able to spot and use indicators that are telling you need to grow or you need to extend or invest. It might not just be staff. It might be technology. It might be investment itself. What kind of indicators have you seen used?
It's hard actually. So the start point is actually is less related to people and more related to how you optimize a business's path, and I use the word optimize rather than maximize, because it's rarely around maximizing. It's always around, you know, taking the optimal path through stuff. And, you know, I'm a massive advocate, and that these days earn my money advising people how to use data to do that better. In every business without exception that I go into, they're not using data well or to the maximum. And so the first things first are, have you got the visibility of how the organization is operating with as good a data points as you can have? And I've over the years I've seen all sorts of analogies, you know, from it's the difference between the instrument panel you have in a car and one you have in a plane. There's so many more things that could go wrong in a plane. That's why you have more instruments than you do in a car, which is basically point and drive, you know. So you know, again, I've described it in the past as being like you know, the control room of London Underground. You know, you know you don't need to know where one train is, you need to know where they all are at any one point in time, because it's a sort of, it's something that is a it works in unison around the whole network. And so it's always about, have I got the visibility in my business that a pilot would have, or the controller of the London Underground would have? And so whenever I go into organizations, the first 6 to 12 months to run them are all about that. I need to have near perfect visibility of everything. That doesn't mean, you know, that I look at everything every day. And in many cases, actually, it means just by telling someone we need a report means that they're looking at the report, knowing that I might look at the report. So it isn't about you actually looking at the stuff all the time, but it's about being able to, if you can. And there's many examples over the years where I've been into businesses where they're sort of shining the torch through the darkness in a certain angle. So they know a view of stuff, but they're shining many torches through the darkness, and they haven't got the light turned on. And that's the difference for me, is you need to, you know, you need to be doing stuff with the lights on and not shining lots of torches through the darkness.
Very good. Yeah. I remember you were quite forthright in how you viewed tracking product, for example, at Ashika, and from both supplier right way through to customer. And not sure we really cracked it as well as we wanted to, but we certainly made it an effort to try and solve that, so we knew where everything was at any point in time.
These things are hard, Ken. You know, they if it was easy, everyone would do it, actually. And, you know, again, some stuff I've worked on recently is creating linkages between customer data and marketing data. And, you know, I've come up with some stuff that enables you to look at customer lifetime value at an individual Google Ads keyword level, which is pretty transformatory in a business, because you're, you know, the whole thing is trying to generate lifetime value that exceeds the marketing cost. So, you know, that's the raison d'etre of businesses. But actually getting systems linked together so that you have that level of visibility is tough. It really is tough. And, you know, the same with the stuff that we were doing with Ashika, the same at M&M, I was trying to get perfect visibility of every order that was effectively born in an organization has a death somewhere, a successful one in terms of it gets delivered or it gets cancelled or whatever it is. It sort of has a life start. And, you know, we created something called the Cradle to Grave Report, which basically gave us visibility of everything across its life. And it wasn't that they didn't know every day that the orders that came into the warehouse got picked and dispatched. They had a report for that, but they didn't know if all the orders that were taken on the website had actually got to the warehouse, you know, or whether after they had been dispatched, whether the courier delivered them. So it's about mapping that out. And there's, you know, plenty of examples over the years of, I remember Tesco Direct, when it first started, it was crazy busy. And it was around Christmas time, and all of a sudden we were getting a load of phone calls in the call center. And what happened is one of the trailers from the courier had just got, it was so busy at Christmas, it just got ignored in the car park of the courier, you know? And so the whole container had not been moved through the network and was just parked up somewhere. And these things happen, you know, even in well-oiled businesses. So, you know, having that as perfect visibility as possible is a great start point. And then I think you start to see some of the wobbles actually in the people in terms of, you know, that data will show you where, you know, where things are slightly awry. So if you have something that shows you all the touch points in an organization, then you can work out when things are longer than the normal level of time at that touch point. So you, again, when we put the cradle to grave report into M&M, you would all of a sudden see that there was a bit of a build up of something, and in this particular case it was orders stuck in the sort of fraud queue, and it was because, you know, Debbie was off sick for a day, you know, or 2 days, and no one had picked up the fact that someone needs to be doing Debbie's work. And it's the same with if someone who's responsible for an area of business is feeling the strain and is underperforming, you'll pretty much see it through the data pretty quickly, as long as you have all those touch points measured.
And how quickly do you think you need to get monitoring systems of that kind up and running? You know, can you survive in your first year without that, just as you build relationships, build your brand, etc.?
Yeah, don't get me wrong, you definitely can. It's just, it's going through the periods of growth that you need them, both as an organization, sort of culturally and people wise, and also as you increase the volume going through that. You know, you just need, you need better visibility to see where the wheels are coming off. You can definitely wing it for a while. But in multiple cases, I've seen it where if a business is growing, you know, anything more than, you know, 20-30% a year, you know, very rapidly, you're going to run into some issues. So I work with a few businesses at the moment with the whole COVID-19 actually. And the interesting thing is the big step change that they've made in just a few weeks, and it's quite interesting to see how they're coping, and it's actually remarkable. It's almost as if they've coped better. Some organizations have coped better with a quadrupling of business over the space of 3 weeks than perhaps they would have with a more steady level of growth. And I'd love to see a study in that at some stage. But I see people screw up more when they're growing at 50% a year than some that have grown, you know, quadruple the business in a space of a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think we'll see a lot of new data out of this period of lockdown on how businesses have managed to adjust and behave, good and bad, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so moving on to having fathomed the barometers of your customers, your product movement, your investment, and so on, it brings us into investment more. So with those indicators clearly stating you need to make the next step, you're now into the realms of, you know, seriously thinking about investment, which would probably be out of most people's comfort zone. So when do you think is the usual time for people to consider investors? And by investors at this stage, I mean bigger organizations of PEs or VCs.
Well, I mean, the reality is it does almost align with that, with those sort of SEIS sort of limits. So the SEIS limits a couple of hundred thousand. And so typically that would be your startup money. The EIS is up to, I think it's up to 5 million, I don't remember the exact number, but so that, and there are EIS funds out there in VCs that people have invested in that then the VCs will then go on and invest in. But there are lots of VCs that will do seed rounds. So before a proper round of, you know, of anything, you know, up to, you know, half a million to a million occasionally, but typically beyond that you're into your Series A, which is a, you know, a proper round. And through all of that, time, again, my experience, because I do a lot of due diligence at all of those stages, you need to demonstrate increased controls in an organization, increased capability. Your business, your financial model needs to become more sophisticated, because I think very much in the early stages, in the early rounds, even from a VC, they're investing in you, the idea, and you, and you know, obviously the numbers need to stack up. But as I said earlier, no one ever knows what those numbers are going to end up like. So it just needs to be something that feels scalable and deliverable by the individual, and that they're driven. as you start to get into more and more rounds, the scrutiny over the economics become greater, and you know, and unfortunately, you get people like me coming and looking at the business models and really challenging those metrics. Whereas it's more of a punt early on in the earlier rounds, and just becomes more of an investment decision in the later rounds.
And I guess that changes the relationship with business owners quite quickly as well, once you start getting to those latter series.
Yeah, and you know, I've pondered on this quite a lot actually, and I guess it sort of raises the question of is it better to work with individuals or better to work with a VC? And even because VCs will put seed money in at an early round, and so you do have a choice. And actually, I think my reflections are, you know, that there are good and bad individuals, and there are, you know, good and bad VCs that you may or may not get on with. And so it does tend to be quite individual based right at the start. And some people are quite happy to be, you know, silent investors, and others are quite proactive, and some of them could be quite a pain and quite a distraction. I've seen that quite a lot, and have too much influence over the business. But definitely, as you shift to more serious investors, they're going to likely to have someone on the board. They'll have a view on life. It may get to a point where, with other shareholders, they've got a controlling interest. So you, as a founder, feel less empowered. But equally, if you're growing, you know, I've always been a believer is I'd rather have, 49% of something that's worth a lot of money than, you know, 51% of something that isn't. And so there's a time when you'd accept that. That's the shift of the scales, as you grow, it tends to be more formal board meetings, and more parties involved, and more sort of hoops to jump through at various points in time.
And we'll come on to exit and planning for that exit in a short while. But what about periods of investment starvation? So here you are. An investor may have ploughed a ton of money in, said enough's enough, I now need to see you get more operationally efficient or deal with some problems that you haven't been dealing with. Is that something you come across much?
Yeah, it's an interesting one when you ponder it, because there are so many businesses out there that I look at and I think, well, they're never going to make any money. And yet they've raised, you know, literally they're unicorns and have raised these, and I won't name them, but I just go through and say, that just never is going to make any money, and people yet they raise it, you know. So sometimes you have to detach yourself a little bit from common sense in some of these scenarios and logic, you know. It's that can be quite crazy, but I think there's definitely been a bit of a shift, though. I think that there was perhaps a period of time when that was more widespread as an ethos. Willing to take higher risks on businesses that perhaps weren't as solid as maybe they should be from a path to profitability perspective. And that definitely in the last couple of years changed quite dramatically, even before COVID-19, where, you know, a lot more conversations were about, you know, how can you demonstrate you can get to profitability? It just wasn't about scale. It was about profitable scale. And I won't mention it by name. There's a business that I've followed that invests money in other businesses, and they're all very much e-commerce businesses. And I was looking at quite a few of them as they were growing, thinking, and I knew that they were publishing their customer KPIs, and I was looking, thinking, that's just not sustainable. Not unless they keep doubling the amount of money they raise every year. And lo and behold, things started to dry up. That they all started to shift towards trying to prove they could be profitable. The sales line, you know, the sales line collapsed relatively, you know. And so, a business that maybe was growing at 100% a year, you know, but losing a load of money, ended up, you know, growing at 0% a year, but moving near its profitability. That ends up being a business that isn't particularly investable at that stage, because, you know, you're not growing. So you may be almost profitable, but you want to buy something that's not growing. So I think, you know, managing your path through that. In, you know, if I'm not saying that if you just go all out for growth, that you may not convince someone to invest in you, because there's always going to be the likelihood that if you cast the net wide enough, someone might buy that. But I've always been a believer of that more sort of controlled, steady growth, keeping an eye on the costs, doing it in a more of a measured way, because it's sort of, it's not a shit or bust strategy. It's one that's sound, you know, grounded in more sort of more solid foundations. And you know, if things are to then, you know, if things are like this happening around, who could have guessed what's happened in the last few months, you know? And I'm sure there's some businesses out there that regretted the amount of investment perhaps they put in, because now they're having to pay out a load of, if they haven't furloughed people, you know, they might have to pay out a load of redundancies to people soon. And, you know, that's all cash, you know, that they may not have. And, you know, so I'm maybe it's the accountant in me. I'm more in the sort of controlled growth rather than the stellar, you know, we can convince people that we're the next unicorn too quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you're an accountant, I can't help but ask. So cash flow is king internally. So what wrongs and rights and pains and growing pains in particular have you seen with regards to management of cash flow?
Yeah, it's all sorts, actually. Well, I have been involved in some fraud, as you know. Not me.
No, in
businesses where too much trust was given in individuals, and they took advantage of that trust. So, and actually, not having good enough controls in general over the accounting side of things, so you couldn't really in a couple of businesses actually where you couldn't really rely on the numbers necessarily. Which is just crazy, because it's the bill and lender. But I think actually what I've over the years and started working with VCs and in these smaller businesses a bit more, it's almost as if the P&L becomes less relevant completely. It literally is, you know, how much cash have I raised, and how long is that going to last me with my burn rate, and that it almost becomes an overriding factor, because you know the point is, if you've done the numbers in the first place that say, look, at a certain level of sales, you know with a certain level of scale, you know, this is going to be a profitable business, you know the fact is then you should almost swing immediately into the short term. It's almost like a cash P&L. You know, what cash have I got coming in, what cash have I got going out, you know? So okay, you know, cash is king, but it's just true. You need to have an obsession with literally when is the money going to run out, because typically you need to start fundraising probably 6 months in advance, you know, maybe a little bit more, depending on, you know, you don't want someone's foot on your throat when you're negotiating with them, because you've only got a month's money left, you know, because then you start to make some stupid decisions. So, you know, you always want to try and be in control.
Yeah, very wise on that one. And I know we have experience.
Yeah.
So I guess before we come on to exit, there's a question I hadn't thought of till you were talking, which is, everybody goes through these pains, and everybody has experiences either as an individual or as a collective business. But where do you go when you're experiencing those pains? Where do you get your third party advice? You know, is it typically the lawyers? Is it the VCs? Is it friends, family? Is it all of the above? You know, what typically can work?
So first and foremost, I think I don't think I've often turned down a conversation with someone in when I've been in that situation. Anyone, you know, you literally will, you know, I mean, there's not, you've got to be careful who you trust with what sort of information, but it, you know, if I'd listen to anyone's opinion, didn't matter how brilliant I thought I was, you know, I don't know everything, and someone would always have a view. And it's, I guess it's your amalgamation and summarization of those views that helps you form your opinion. So I would talk to all of the above. One of the things that I enjoy through my role right now is, which is can be quite varied with organizations, but there's always 5-10% of it of helping them just give my view of where they are, the things they're doing well, the things they aren't, I don't think they're doing so well, and being honest with them about that. Often I'd say, I won't put a percentage on it, but there's, a large proportion will be really engaged with the view, and some of the would think, who are you? I've even had conversations with people where I've said, look, this is what I do, and they'd say, well, we've already got someone who's a data expert or a digital marketing expert or whatever it is, and I'm like, well, I know, but are they the only expert? Surely you'd want another view, yes, in life, and I'd take 20 people's view if it helped me optimize that. So I'm just a believer of talk to anyone you can, and then your strength as a leader and a founder is to basically come up with the right, the right balance of the summary of what they've all said, and then make the right decisions based on it.
Yeah, very wise. I think I'm a believer of you can learn from anyone, quite literally anyone. And so not necessarily a growing pain, but certainly a pain, and probably an underestimated one, is planning an exit, of which we were both involved. I can think of one anyway. I've been involved in a few, but that one in particular, planning an exit is a huge stretch and takes some doing, and in itself is a growing pain of sorts. Is there any advice you can offer people around your experience around planning those exits?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always, most people going into whatever they do have got an eye on that at some stage in the future they won't be doing it anymore, and they want some sort of crystallization of that. And one of the biggest things you can do to help yourself on the way is just keep your housekeeping in order in terms of documents, and because it's all going to be asked for at some stage, whether it's share certificates or a loan covenant or whatever it is, and you'd be amazed how many people just don't have them to hand because they're too busy being creative and driving the business forward. So it may sound a bit dull, but just keeping all of that stuff in one place and digitalizing it and keeping copies of it would just make your life so much easier. I have come across situations where those exits come very rapidly, and you need to be ready for it. So if someone identifies you as an acquisition target, and I think there'll be quite a lot of that happening right now, you want to be ready, because if they've identified three people and you're the one that's going to take too long to get your acting together to help them get through that process, then they'll just write you off as part of that process, and you want to be there, and strike while the iron's hot. And if they're putting a certain value on you now, you don't want to wait, 3 months while you get your act in order, because that value can go down as well as up, so being ready, so you're in control, back to, you might pay you to wait 3 months, but at least you can make that decision rather it be made, yes, because you haven't got your documents together. I went to a really good thing that Ernst & Young did not so long ago with lots of entrepreneurs around, being ready, and they would preach that it happens, even further out. You need to be managing, not just sort of 6 months in advance, but you need to start thinking about it, beyond that, in terms of planning for what you're going to do, because a process could take 6 months, but you want to be ready for the process. You want to start building in things into your business plan that make the business more attractive. You might want to fill some key hires in, all of that sort of stuff, succession planning, all of the things that might come as a risk factor in an exit, and typically, again, back to that strength of the team, many occasions when someone invests, whether it's a PE or whether it's when you float a business or even when you sell it, I would imagine probably 9 out of 10 times the person who was the founder of the business probably leaves, and it's more of an exception where they stay. So you need to have a good team around you, which can be quite, as a founder, you like to be seen as the one that is almost you know, irreplaceable and, you know, is the heart of the business. But the fact is you have to transition at a point in time where you're not, because, you know, no one's going to invest in a business that's about you when knowing that, you know, you've walked away with a large sum of money and, you know, you might not be as motivated as you were the day before, you know. So it's really important to get that bench strength up. And even this, you know, as you grow, I mean, I'm not talking about small businesses, it could be businesses with, you know, a couple of hundred people in it. It's not just a level, you know, it's just not just the founder or the CEO or even the couple of key hires. It's the people even below them that need to be of good enough strength so people can see this is a sustainable business, even if one or two senior people leave.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, is there anything we haven't spoken about that struck you during the course of the conversation that you thought, yeah, that's another topic that, you know, we would be covering?
Yeah, no, I've said it. The thread through all of this, and I hate to be a bore on it, is for me, it is data. It's using data as you grow to basically be more in control of that. And data's numbers and finance and whatever it is. It's all to do with measurement of progress, and planning and measuring yourself against that plan and being in control. And I think you want to try and take as many of the variables and make some of them constants. Yes. because the way you do that is with data, in my view. So you can lock things down and be more in control of them if you're measuring them and judging yourself against them, and then you're taking that out of the equation because you've got enough to be dealing with in a fast growing business without having to sort of juggle all these things and not be in control of all of them at the same time, because you'll screw one up. So the more that you can lock down using data and feeling like you're in control, the more you're likely to outperform on the things that really need your help.
Steve, it's been fascinating and great insights. So thank you very much for participating in the podcast. We skirted through topics like nobody's business at high pace. I'm sure there's lots of room for going deeper on those in the future. But otherwise, thank you very much.
Yeah, not a problem.
Thanks for listening to the Change Society podcast. Sullivan & Stanley is an award-winning specialist change consultancy that deploys expert teams to solve the challenges companies face when undertaking change. To find out more, please head over to our website, SullivanStanley.com.